we are looking at Jesus and getting to know Jesus through the Old Testament. And so far in our study, we have spent our time in the first 17 verses of the Gospel of Matthew. And though that may seem kind of a strange place to start, when you're talking about getting to know Jesus through the Old Testament, it really is the perfect place to start, because what it does is it really shows for us Jesus' connection to the Old Testament and his place in history. In the history of the Old Testament, one of the things that we observed at the beginning of this study is that for most people, their knowledge of Jesus, the information that they have, comes primarily from the New Testament. And that even being said, typically when we begin reading the story of Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew, which is the first book in the New Testament, people like to start at verse 18. Because verses 1 through 17 is that boring genealogy. So-and-so was the father of so-and-so, who was the father of so-and-so, and of course we don't like to read all of those, but we've seen thus far in our study how important those genealogies are and what specifically they say about Jesus and his relationship to those Old Testament times and those Old Testament people. We saw, for instance, just by way of review real quickly, that Jesus was a real Jew. That's what the genealogies show us. That he, when Jesus was here living on this earth, he lived as a Jew. He had all of his Jewishness, if you will, that came from his past, from his ancestors, and so forth. We saw also that Jesus was a real man. We notice the emphasis that Matthew places on Jesus, and especially in two particular areas, noting one that he was the son of Abraham and also the son of David. Those two in particular are significant. Why? What's the significance of Jesus being associated or pointed out as the son of Abraham? Okay, all right. He becomes the fulfillment of the promise that God made to Abraham. We're going to talk more about that in just a few minutes, that through you all nations of the earth would be blessed, or through your seed. That refers to the genealogy, you see. And then, of course, there is David. He's the son of David. And what's the significance there? Okay.
And then the Messiah will come through that
room. Okay. That we're talking about him being the king, okay? He's going to come, the Messiah is going to come and establish a kingdom and so forth. Well, being the heir of David or descendant of David places him in that lineage of the monarchy, okay? Now, there's another important, very significant aspect of this that we saw last time we were talking about. In this genealogy, that Matthew makes a point of making sure that we are aware of five significant people. Who were they? Women, but not just women, any women, but specifically what kind of women? Gentile women. That within that lineage also, there were some mothers there of these ancestors of Jesus who were Gentiles. Okay? Now, the reason that that's so significant is what? Okay, exactly. And that we begin to look at Jesus not just simply as a Jewish Messiah, but rather as a Messiah of all nations, you see. When we put it this way, and it's one of the ways that we stated last week, the Messiah, Jesus the Jew, had Gentile blood in him.
Yes, he did.
You see? And that's significant to understand and remember, you see, that we look at Jesus in that way. That didn't happen by accident. Because, again, it goes all the way back to that promise. We saw also that Jesus is the end of the time of preparation. In other words, in Matthew's genealogy, verse 17, he basically kind of summarizes the generations that have been There were 14 generations from Abraham to David, 14 from David to the exile to Babylon, and 14 from the exile to Christ. And just all of these things up to that point have been stated about Jesus in this genealogy show that all of these things have been in preparation for the coming of Jesus. And so in that regard, Jesus is the end of the time of preparation. Okay? But then also, finally, last week we were looking at it and said he's also a new beginning. In that sense, he's the end of the beginning, that is the Old Testament, and he is the beginning of the end. There's no other time after the New Testament time, which is what we are in right now. You see? And so in that regard, Jesus is the end of the beginning and the beginning of the end. When Jesus came, he started or he began that period of history that will bring about the end of all times. Thus, we looked at it and just kind of made a note of the term genealogy, which is how Matthew starts. And that term basically means what? It is a genesis or a beginning. You see? And so Matthew starts out his gospel pointing us in all of these different aspects to Jesus and his connection to the Old Testament. Now, what we're going to do this morning is we're going to go in a little bit more at some of these things and look at, again, the story so far. Where are we in looking at and understanding Jesus and his connection to this whole thing? So we start out this morning looking at from Abraham to David. Okay? From Abraham to David. Now, when we look at what the Bible has to say in the time just before God calls Abraham, Abram, okay, first, what is taking place during this particular period in history? What do we read about? Okay? It's the Tower of Babel. Okay? Summarize what's taking place here. In this particular period of the history of humanity, what's going on?
Well, in terms of man's relationship to God, he's doing everything the opposite, pretty much. God wanted man to fulfill the earth. Man said, no, I'll build a tower so we won't scatter.
Okay.
God had to come down and scatter man.
Okay.
And basically, man was just, the world was full of evil.
Okay.
Sin pretty much reigned.
All right.
The Babylonians at the time, the Chaldeans, they worshipped the stars. That's where astrology came from.
Okay.
It was from this time frame. They thought that they could look at the constellations of the heaven, and figure things out.
Okay. So what we have is this grand or great apostasy on the part of mankind from following after Jehovah God. Okay. From following after the one true God. We have in this particular point in human history, a couple of significant things. Number one, as you said, Steve, mankind has been scattered throughout all the earth, but the other significant aspect of that is what? What happened also in this time of scattering? Their language was confused so that, they can't communicate with each other anymore. Okay? So we look at this story of the Tower of Babel really is, in a sense, as one person put it, the climax of prehistory. Okay? It is the point in which the effects of sin have reached global proportions. Okay? So in other words, sin and man's disobedience to God is not just confined to one particular section of the earth anymore, but man is scattered throughout the earth from this point on as a result of their disobedience to God or sin. Okay? So One can look at that particular aspect of it, and what we see is that humanity, mankind, at this particular point, is scattered throughout the earth in division and confusion. Okay? You've got all these different nations, and there's a lot of confusion because they can't communicate with one another anymore. Now, with that kind of a setting, okay, that is the situation of mankind in the world, okay, at that particular time, then the question then needs to be asked at that particular point, is there any hope for humanity in this condition of division and confusion? Is there any hope at all? In other words, can the nations that have been scattered and confused, can they be gathered again and restored to God's favor and blessing? See? We look at the situation of mankind, we look at the state of the world, okay? At that point, it looks rather grim, doesn't it? Okay? And what is the one dominant factor that makes it as grim as it really is? Any thoughts on that? What is the result of sin? Separation from God. Mankind, at this particular point, finds himself separated from God as humanity. Okay? In other words, you know, when you read through the narrative after the time of Noah, okay, Noah and his sons and their wives and his wife come out of the ark, okay, and they begin to repopulate the earth and so forth. But what do we find happening? We find sin. See? And so, in these succeeding generations, from the time of Noah to the time of the Tower of Babel, is there anyone that stands out, anyone that we are told about that stands out as being, you know, the righteous persons or a righteous group of people, you know, that are honoring God and so forth? No, there's really not. Now, that's not to say that there aren't those who are following God, okay, who believe in God, okay. But in this whole part of the narrative of the Old Testament, we're not told of anybody specifically that is standing out in humanity, you see, a group of people that are following God where the rest of the nations are all doing their thing against God and so forth. Basically, we see humanity, and the picture that we see from the Scriptures is that humanity as a whole basically is departing from God. Okay? And then there is the election. Okay? The problem is man's separation from God. There is then the answer to that problem is the election. To the question, can the nations be gathered and restored to God's favor and blessing? God answers that with a resounding yes. Okay? But specifically, how does he answer that question? Go ahead, Tom. It's on the tip of your tongue. You want to say it. Go ahead. Okay, yeah. He calls Abram. Okay? And, you know, when you look at it, you know, here we're in chapter 12 of the book of Genesis. Okay? And you look at God's answer to the problem that man has, that man is separated from God, thus lost, God's answer is a 75-year-old man who is childless at this point, okay? And, you know, not a whole lot of hope from a human perspective that that's going to change any. His wife, Sarai, is barren. Okay? But yet he is the one that God chooses to bring hope to mankind. Okay? Or through him to do that. God promises this 75-year-old Abram a son. And it is through that son that the promise and the hope to mankind was given. As we've mentioned time and time again, the promise is what? Through you or your seed, all nations will be blessed. Okay? Now, when God made that promise to Abraham, which nations was he referring to? All of those that had been scattered all over with their language confused and so forth, right? Was it those or was it the nation of Israel? How do we know that? Israel didn't even exist at that point, did it? Which is a very significant point we need to keep in mind. You see, Israel didn't exist as a nation. You see, God chose one man out of all humanity at that time. One man. To bring about his hope. You see? Now, one of the reasons why that is so significant is that we understand, when we understand the nature of the problem that existed, okay, that man was separated by God, what does that then tell us concerning the whole idea of election? Okay, you understand what I mean by that? We're not talking about what's going to happen on Tuesday, okay? We're talking about the idea of God electing to save someone or a group of someones or any someones. How did that choice come about? This is significant. It's one word that I'm looking for. Starts with a G. Ends with an E.
Grace.
Thank you. It is grace, and it is only grace. You see? In other words, when you understand and you look at the situation and the condition of mankind at that time, was there anyone that was deserving of God saying, okay, you deserve to be saved and restored to me because you're such a great person, because you've been obeying me, you've been living your life for me all this time, and so I'm going to save you. Was there anyone that we know of that meets that category? Absolutely not. And the reason that's so significant to understand is because what it demonstrates to us is man's total depravity. Okay? Man is totally and completely unworthy because of sin. And it is by God's choosing, God's desire, God's grace and mercy that He chooses Abram, this 75-year-old man, fatherless man, out of everyone in the world, to begin working out his plan to restore the nations to him. Abraham was God's choice. And it was by God's choosing, not by anything that Abraham had done. He was God's choice to bless all the nations. And thus God's identity was attached to Abraham. Okay? Think about it. God's identity was attached to Abraham. Okay? What do we mean by that? How did God become known to people later on? How was God described? Was he not described as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? You see? God's identity was attached to Abraham in that way. He became the one through which the promise would be carried out. Abraham was known and was referred to hundreds and hundreds of years later by this nation that was not a nation when he started, but would become a nation. Abraham was referred to by them as their father. Why? He was the father of nations. He was the father of the promise that God had given to them. And so therefore he was Father Abraham. Any thoughts, comments as we're going through here? I know I'm just kind of putting this stuff out here, but you can, you know, jump in anytime. Steve?
Genesis 12 has always been it's an interesting chapter in that God chose Abraham, and as he's laid out for us, there wasn't really anything necessarily particularly special about Abram at the time. And, you know, to have been a fly on the wall, you know, and heard some of those conversations. How did Abram know, okay, really even who, you know, God referred to here as the I Am, Yahweh, how did he really know who he was when God first spoke to him? You know? Yeah, we don't know. I mean, there's no way of knowing, but, you know, evidently he, you know, okay, and he got up and he left, and he stopped at various times and built altars, you know, and worshiped God. And I've always just found that rather fascinating. You know, that he knew enough to do this, you know.
Well, the only explanation I have for it is that, you know, when God wants to get something done, you know, and in this particular case, when he's talking about the most significant and important thing that's ever happened in the history of mankind, that's our redemption, okay? Is God going to do it in such a way that Abraham would know exactly who it was that was doing it? Or is he going to do it in a way that Abraham would kind of go, I had a dream last night. I don't know if it was a dream or was I, you know, what was happening here? I'm not really sure. God wants to get it done. However he did it, I suppose he did it in a way that Abraham had no doubt whatsoever that it was God that had called him and had a task for him to do.
Well,
you see?
That is the way the narrative reads.
Yeah.
You know, there isn't any of this stuttering and stammering that we see with Moses.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, it's just like, pack up, we're leaving, you know.
Exactly. So however it was that God called him, you see, the only thing I can assume is that it was in some kind of a way that Abraham knew this is what it's all about. You see, this is God that I'm dealing with here, and so I'm going to do what he tells me to do.
I'd like to thank also as maybe going back even after the disobedience of man and the fall of man, God in his infinite wisdom knew that he had to try to get man back to him. And the only way he's going to get man, he's going to have to use man to serve man to do that. And, you know, I'd just like to think that God was just, I mean, he'll never be able to, as Steve just mentioned, he'll never know all everything that there is to know. But I'd like to think that God needed us as much as we needed him. He said it.
Right.
And ever since the fall of man,
Yeah, and you know, if you think about it too, in that way, you know, since man was the one that messed everything up, then doesn't it, in a sense, it makes sense that man is the one who has to be involved in this process of restoration of the relationship with God? In other words, it's got to depend on us, and we're going to see that more here in just a minute, how it depends upon us. When I say us, I'm just talking about mankind in general here, because it cannot be and could not be all on God's part. Okay? So we look at that idea of the election. In other words, and again, it's important that we understand, you know, the whole concept of, because if that really basically lays the foundation for what grace is all about, that the reason that God chose Abraham was not because Abraham was a good guy and, you know, and was, you know, necessarily, we have no indication. If you read the narrative from chapter 11, which is again the genealogy, the account from Shem on, there's no indication in any of this, you know, that, you know, we have these folks that there's no statements, in other words, that any of these descendants are these great faithful followers of God in here. We're just told who begat so-and-so and how long they lived and so forth, you see. They had sons and daughters and then they died. So we look at Abraham and God choosing him. Now, you know, I'm not suggesting at all that there wasn't something about Abraham that God liked. Okay, I'm not suggesting that at all, you see. And it's not suggesting either that mankind totally and completely had abandoned God and no one was acknowledging God at all. Apparently, out of this group, and we find other things in the Bible of the lineage from Adam on, we find this lineage, you see, that indicates that these are people that were faithful to God to at least some extent. The problem is we have no indication, we have nothing that tells us in these narratives of what they were doing, you see, in terms of any kind of worship to God, in terms of any kind of acknowledgement to God or anything. We don't have anything that tells us that from the time, really, of the Tower of Babel when they decided to build this tower to make a name for themselves. We're not really told, you say, of who's doing what, you say. And we're not told at this particular point concerning Abraham, you know, that Abraham was this overly righteous person that, you know, was following God in righteousness and so on and so forth. We find a tremendous amount of statements after the fact, don't we, about Abraham's faithfulness to God, you say. So we look at this particular point and we recognize God is choosing Abraham for whatever reason. And again, we look at all these different statements the Bible makes, and one of the most significant, I think, in all of the Scriptures, principles that we have to keep in mind is that God looks upon man's heart. Okay? So we, you know, the only thing that I can take from that whole situation is that God looked upon Abraham's heart, or Abram at the time, looked upon his heart and said, here's the man. You say, here's where it's going to start. But not that, that's not an indication that Abraham or Abram at that particular time was this overly righteous person who was doing everything that God wanted him to do and so forth. Okay, Peggy? Probably so. In a sense, it's almost like Abraham probably, amongst everybody else, stood out. You see? That's just kind of the impression that I get. But that still, we have to understand, it's still an issue of election, because that doesn't tell us Abraham deserved this. You see? It was simply God's choosing that said, here's the man that I'm going to begin fulfilling this plan with. Okay? So we have that election there. Next we come to the redemption. Okay, God has chosen to reach out to all of the nations through this one man to redeem or reconcile man to himself, or in other words, to gather the scattered nations back to himself. Okay, and so then we look at the whole concept of this redemption, and what does it tell us? Well, the story of the Exodus is really the primary model of what redemption means in the Bible. Okay? When you go to the story of the Exodus, what we see there is this chosen people, and by that time they had been a chosen people, right? Okay? By the time the Exodus, they are a chosen people. They have become a nation unto themselves, a separate nation from all the other nations of the world. They became the nation of Israel. This chosen people at that particular time were enslaved, and they were delivered from that slavery in a demonstration of God's supremacy over all nations. You see how this story unfolds. The problem is we have the nations of the world that are steeped in sin, and they're scattered throughout the world, separated from God. And God's plan as it unfolds is to make or create one nation that would be separate from all of these other nations in order to be able to eventually gather all of the other nations unto himself. In order to make that happen, God demonstrates his supremacy not over simply that one nation that he's chosen, but rather over all the nations of the earth. Who but God alone could have done the things that were done to the nation of Egypt in order to set free the nation of Israel? You see? And so God is demonstrating his supremacy over the nations of the world. No one is powerful enough, no nation on earth is powerful enough to thwart the plans of Almighty God. And so God is still exerting his will and his supremacy over mankind. And so we really need to make sure that we understand that concept, because it is throughout the Bible. God is the God of all men, not just one nation or one person or one people. He is the God of everyone. And he's the God of everyone, whether everyone accepts him or not. You see? And that's a significant point that we need to understand. The Egyptians, and particularly Pharaoh, did not accept or acknowledge God, did it? You know, who is this God that I should listen to him? Was Pharaoh's response, right? And God demonstrated to him who he was. You see? So it does not require that nations, any nation, acknowledge God's existence and God's supremacy in order for God to maintain that supremacy over those nations. How are we doing on time? We're doing pretty good here. Okay. Let's talk then from there about the covenant. So we have this redemption plan where God is demonstrating his supremacy over all of the nations by freeing this one nation from another. And this, again, is the model of redemption throughout the Bible. But involved in that redemption, there is a covenant. Okay? There is a covenant. After leading the Israelites as a nation out of Egypt, where does God take them to? Mount Sinai. Okay? And what significant things happen at Mount Sinai?
Well, Moses goes up to have a conversation with God.
Okay.
He stays up there a long time amidst lightning and thunder. And the Israelites get a little bit bored, and they decide that it's time to make a god they can worship.
Okay.
And so they make the golden calf. And Moses gets the law from God.
Okay.
Comes back down and sees what Israel's done, and God has to punish them.
Okay.
Many of them died and were swallowed up by the earth at that time, and then also the rest, every adult at the time, got to wander in the wilderness for 40 years instead of going straight to the land of promise.
Okay. But and all of that is, you know, those are the events surrounding, but the most significant part of all that is that at Mount Sinai, God establishes with this one new nation, He establishes a covenant, does He not? And that covenant is a law, okay? It is, and basically a covenant is an agreement or a contract between two people or two parties, okay? And so it's there at Mount Sinai that He enters into a covenant relationship with the nation of Israel. And this is where we see the separation that takes place of Israel as a nation from all the other nations of the earth, you see, is in this covenant relationship. Okay? Now, that doesn't mean that they hadn't already, in a sense, been separated by God. Okay? They had already been acknowledged by God as being a nation, the nation of Israel, and they had special favor and so forth. We can read all the different stories the way that God had taken care of them. But the covenant relationship is significant because God did not enter into a covenant relationship with any other nation on earth. Right? Exactly.
He wanted them to follow. And those laws were to be that I received, and He wanted to make sure that you obeyed these laws.
Right.
That's why it made it so significant. You didn't make any laws with any other nation.
That's right.
But that would make it so unique.
Exactly. The covenant basically stated, I will be your God, and you will be my people, right? And again, God didn't establish a covenant like that with any other nation on earth, with any other people, except Israel. But we need to understand that that covenant was based on what God had already done for Israel. Okay? And that is significant. God would provide sovereignty and blessing to the Israelite people. They were to provide loyalty and obedience. This was the basis of the covenant. That's one reason why God, and you hear it referred to as you study and you look at Israel's disobedience to God, and what was it that God over and over again referred to their disobedience as? Somebody help me out here. What kind of a generation did He refer to them as? A what? A rebellious and adulterous generation. They were unfaithful in their covenant to God. You see. And God saw that as adultery or breaking of the covenant, you see, that He had with them. And that's one reason why I believe the Scriptures make it very clear, and God says, I hate adultery. Why? Because it is covenant breaking. That's what adultery is. You see? And that's how He looked upon the Israelite people. But you see, it's important again to understand that the covenant was based on what God had already done. He already brought them out of slavery in Egypt and then took them to the mountain and gave them the law. You see? So it's based on God's actions first and His call for the Israelite people as a nation to respond to what He has already done to them. Their obedience, in other words, was to be, by God's design, a grateful response to what God had already accomplished for them. His grace and redemptive action came first. say. And their obedience was called upon second. And, you know, one of the things that's significant also about that is when you think about Abraham and God calling him, does that not make Abraham's obedience more powerful, since he acted simply on a promise? When God called Abraham out of the Ur of the Chaldees, and Abraham obeyed him and followed him, God at that point had not done anything, you see, to demonstrate his power and so forth to Abraham, like he had done with Israel. He just simply called him, and Abraham, out of faith, obeyed. But when it came time for the nation, God demonstrated to them, and he acted first, and then called upon them to obey him. Finally, real quickly, let me finish this particular section up here. We have the inheritance. God promised them, that is, the Israelite nation, a land of inheritance, or the promised land, as we refer to it most of the time. That first generation that God had made that promise to perished in the wilderness. Why? Because of their unbelief, because of their disobedience and breaking of the covenant. Succeeding generations followed in disobedience to God, with all of that disobedience climaxing at the time of Samuel, where the Israelite people as a nation rejected God as their king and made a demand that they be given an earthly king to reign over them like all the other nations around them had. And the reason that that statement is so significant is that they wanted to be the same as every other nation when God had specifically intended for them to be different than all other nations. And so they rebelled against God, and it's at that particular point that God established the monarchy. And David became the model for that. And that's where we'll pick up our study next week, is looking at from David to the exile. All right? Thank you all.